Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I hope you're doing well. My name is Dave Marshall and I'm your host, and this is episode 102 on small shelly fossils, in which I interview Dr. Marissa Betts of the University of New England in Australia. In the first part of this two-part episode, we cover art student squats, disgusting parties, and the ratification of stages of the earliest Cambrian. In the second part, we get to grips with some of the weird fossil organisms found immediately at the start of the Cambrian period, and Marissa gets haunted by a ghost. But before we jump into the interview, I just wanted to say a big thanks to all those who voted for us in the podcast awards. Unfortunately, we didn't make the top 10 this year, but then again, we decided to swim amongst the bigger fish in the science category, as opposed to the education category, in which we were a regular contestant. It really means a lot that you took the time to vote, so that's greatly appreciated. But to our fans, I just wanted to apologise for the late delay in the release of this episode. Within the last few weeks, I had to move house on really short notice to take up a once-in-a-lifetime job opportunity. I'll be able to tell you about it in probably about 2 years, but until then, just know that I'm doing something that most paleontologists could only dream of, and it's going to be absolutely massive. So the day after we recorded our interview, Marissa travelled out to do fieldwork in Mongolia, and she documented her time in the field on her Instagram account at 200 micron. So that's at the number 200 and the word micron. So make sure you check out her account and give her a follow. And whilst you're on social media, make sure you're also following us across all the various platforms and like and share everything to help us reach the biggest audience we can. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Marissa. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hi.
So we want to get to know you before we jump into details about early Cambrian chronostratigraphy. So what was your route into paleontology? How did you become a paleontologist?
Well, I got into paleo a bit later. I wasn't one of those people that decide they're going to be a paleontologist at the age of eight. After I finished high school, I enrolled in a visual arts degree, and I never really did science at school. I did a little bit, but at school I was mostly doing visual art and making things, photography, design. I did technical drawing as well. And so when I finished, I wanted to do more creative visual art stuff. And I did that for about a year and a half and realized that maybe I wasn't very good. Well, maybe it just wasn't the right course for me. And it was more about sort of a lot of theory behind fine art. And so maybe what I would have liked more would be something like product design. Like, I think that I like making things that people use, and so it wasn't really the right thing for me, and I ended up quitting halfway through. But I did a good like year and a half of this course, and I eventually quit, and then I went traveling for a while. And I think that this training in visual art, we were always sort of told to go to galleries and museums and stuff like this. And so when I was traveling, I went and lived in the UK for a little while.
Okay, whereabouts?
Ireland. Hey?
Whereabouts?
Well, I moved to Dublin first. So I was in Ireland for 6 months, and then I lived in London for a year and a half.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, I was there a little while ago. That was like 2005, 2006. And so, London was amazing because there are so many galleries and museums and things to go and see. Like, and so I was always every weekend going out and doing that sort of stuff. And I would go back again and again to the Natural History Museum in Kensington. And I found that more and more, like, the natural history museums and science museums were like speaking to me more than going to art galleries and things. And I thought, oh, you know, this sounds like a cool thing to kind of get involved with. And so when I came home back to Australia, after all of that, I wanted to enroll in a university course that would sort of help me do something like that. And I eventually enrolled in a museum studies degree at Macquarie University in Sydney. They had this course there about museum studies. And I liked that one because it was sort of taking it from like a natural science perspective rather than a humanities or an arts perspective. And so I did that. And part of that degree was doing, I had to do some geology and biology and stuff. And I just really like rocks all of a sudden. Like the rocks really spoke to me. Or maybe it was because like when I was studying the geology subjects, I met some really cool people and I made lots of good friends doing geology. And I felt like, you know, we would always end up at the pub afterwards, which is pretty classic for studying geo subjects. And so, I don't know, we all got along really well. And I eventually switched my entire degree over to geology. So I was doing a Bachelor of Science. And then at the end of the degree, pretty much, I kind of counted all up the subjects and I was like, oh, well, if I do, you know, a couple more paleo subjects, I'll get a major in paleo. And so I did some subjects with who was going to be my future PhD supervisor, Glenn Brock, at Macquarie University. And I just really loved those subjects. And I felt like it all just made a lot of sense to me. And I remember at the time, because I was in a geology degree, there was a mining boom, right, in Australia, and everybody was getting like really high-paid jobs. Like they were getting sort of headhunted before they'd even finished. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be great. Like I'm going to graduate. I'm going to make all this money. It's going to be awesome. And then just as I graduated, the mining boom crashed and like there were no jobs and I was like, oh no. And so I thought, oh well, you know, maybe I'll keep studying. And because I was really enjoying paleo, I just sort of stuck with that. And I'd approach Glenn about doing some more work or volunteering in the lab, and he ended up hiring me as a lab assistant. So I worked for the lab for quite a while, and I saw how his lab was run, and I really liked the feel in his lab. And so, yeah, I ended up doing an honours project with him, and which was very successful. And off the back of that, he offered or suggested that I do a PhD as well. And so that's that work is the chronostratigraphic work that we wanted to chat about today.
It's crazy to think that back in 2006, I was pretty much like just starting my first paleontological MSc, and you were living in London as an ex-artist traveller.
Yeah, I was living. I was living in a squat in like in Zone 2. We didn't pay rent or anything. Like it was just like wild times, man. But yeah, humble beginnings.
And a question that we always ask everyone as well is, what would you be doing if you weren't a paleontologist now? And to be honest with you, it sounds like it could be anything.
Yeah. I think, you know, often I wonder, like, if I had my time again, and I still love the creative side of things, and I make things now, and I'm a member of the pottery club in Armidale where I live. And so I think that if I, like, knowing myself now and I had the time to go back, like, you know, when I quit that art degree, I should have done product design. Like I should have done something like that, like that, where I could make things for people, like designing cool toothbrushes or something like this. Like, I think that I would really enjoy that. But yeah.
Yeah, toothbrush designer is unique. We've never had that answer before.
Oh, well. Look, we're just getting started here.
Yeah. Something else we've never discussed before is the early Cambrian, and it's by biostratigraphy, chronostratigraphy, stratigraphy, chemostratigraphy. No, not really. So why the earliest Cambrian? Why did you start working on fossils from this time opposed to, say, the enigmatic and mysterious fossils, the Rangiomorphs from the Ediacaran period just before, or the outstanding diversity of life just a little bit later, say like the Burgess Shale or Chenjiang? Why the earliest Cambrian?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it boils down to Glenn Brock, my supervisor at Macquarie. Because when I suggested to him that I would like to do an honours project, and he likes for students to sort of have ownership of their own work. And so he said, go away and think of something that you are interested in and come back. And I said, okay. So I went away and I thought about it, and I did like the Ediacaran. And I thought, I think that's a really, like, a super cool, interesting period of time, right? And so I came back and suggested the Ediacaran. And Glenn listened to me very carefully, and he's nodding, and but then he said, because he is like Mr. Small Shelly Fossil in Australia, like he's, working on the early Cambrian of the Flinders Ranges and has done for quite some time. And he listened to me, and he was nodding, and he said, that's cool. Have you considered Small Shelly Fossils? And I said, maybe. And it made a lot of sense. Like the Ediacaran, in Australia, and I think maybe elsewhere the world, can be quite hard to break into. I think a lot of people have, their sites and their material, and it's, unless you're working directly with them, it can be very hard to be a new kid on the block, I guess. And Glenn has had so much experience and success with the early Cambrian in South Australia. The packages of rocks that he's been studying in the Flinders Ranges and also south of the Flinders, I have to say they're probably some of the best in the world. They're the thickest packages of early Cambrian limestones that you'd like to see. They're beautifully preserved and they're really nicely exposed. So we have a really remarkable repository of early Cambrian rocks and fossils in South Australia. So it was a bit of a no-brainer, I think, in the end to work on that.
I like how you were like, small shelly fossils. It's kind of a parallel to what our audience is going to go through. They're going to be tuning in just like, small shellies, I'm not sure about this interview, but by the end of it. Yeah. They're going to be loving them.
Yeah. They're amazing little things. They really are.
Right. Well, before we get into the details of those, can you tell us what was going on in the earliest Cambrian, both geologically and biologically?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Ediacaran, the early Cambrian, or the Cambrian explosion, as people like to call it, I guess is best understood when we think about it in the context of what was happening before in the Ediacaran, in the pre-Cambrian. And so before the earliest Cambrian, the world was dominated, in terms of life, by microbes for something like 2 billion years, right? We've had the Earth dominated by microbial life. And then things changed a lot. At the very end of the sort of pre-Cambrian in the Ediacaran, and what we see in the fossil record are the Ediacaran fauna. So this very unique soft-bodied fauna, but we don't really know. There's some evidence now coming out that they might be related to animals, but they're, for a lot of them, it's very hard to find that evidence that they might actually be directly related to the animals that exist today. And in the very lowest part of the Cambrian, we do start to see animal life evolve, and it happens very fast, and that's why they call it the Cambrian explosion. So what happens there, we see the evolution very suddenly of lots of different types of animal body plans. So mostly bilaterian life, things that are bilaterally symmetrical, and also the advent of complex biomineralization, biomineralized skeletons, and also complex relationships, ecological relationships. So predator-prey relationships for the first time, symbioses for the first time. So everything we really understand about modern communities, all of that had its roots all the way back down in the early Cambrian.
So how important are Largestetter, the sites of special preservation or concentration, such as the Burgess Shale or Chenjiang, in understanding what was going on in the Cambrian? Because surely they provide us the greatest view of what's happening.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I mean, the sites of exceptional preservation like the Burgess Shale and the Chenjiang are super important for us to have a very special window into early Cambrian and middle Cambrian communities, because they preserve soft structures. So you get lots more information that you normally would from things that are biomineralizing, for example. But I guess the Burgess Shale is of Middle Cambrian age, and there's some new paper that came out actually by John Patterson, who's in the department here at the University of New England, and he looked at trilobites and their evolutionary rates in the early Cambrian to try and tackle this question of how fast was the Cambrian explosion? Like, was it really an explosion? Because people have been arguing for some time about whether this is just some sort of artifact or the way we're reading the fossil record. His results suggested that, the Cambrian explosion was actually quite short, and it's probably restricted only to the very early part of the Cambrian, and that it was over in a burst, pretty much, and that communities like the Burgess Shale, which is Middle Cambrian, even though they contain lots of really crazy critters with really weird body plans, that by that stage the explosion had kind of settled down, and what you're actually looking at are snapshots of what are essentially modern style ecosystems.
Yeah, we've had John on before, Pato. We should refer to him by his real name. So he better be listening to this.
Yeah.
So this interview is going to be concerned about the stratigraphy of the earliest Cambrian. So can you start us off from the basics? What is stratigraphy?
Yeah, cool. Well, I guess stratigraphy is that a branch of geological science, of geology, that is concerned with rocks in layers. So the layering of sedimentary rocks, usually we're talking about. We can also think about volcanic rocks in this sort of way, because a volcanic eruption can produce ashes that get sandwiched within other sedimentary layers. So stratigraphy is looking at rock strata. So if you're standing at a cliff, for example, and you can see the sort of bedding in the cliff, and the rocks on the bottom are the oldest ones, and they get progressively younger as you work your way to the top. So that's stratigraphy.
I like to think of it as, you know, pick up sticks. You've got so many different little sticks overlying each other, and knowing which one's at the bottom and which one overlies the other one, and they might... that's not a good analogy.
Well, you know, I sometimes think about stratigraphy or stratigraphic analogies, and I've read one which was like, if every day you read a newspaper and then you chuck it in the corner, and then every day you read one and chuck it on top of the pile, when you look at the dates on the papers on the bottom are going to have the oldest dates, and the ones on the top are going to have the youngest dates. I think about it as well, like sometimes... what was it? Oh, yes, like my brother used to live in a terrible share house, and they used to have the most disgusting parties, and they never cleaned up. and I would go and visit, and I call it the sort of the party stratigraphic detritus, right? And so the oldest crap on the bottom of the floor was from the parties that were, you know, longer ago. And so all of the crap just kept building up on top of it. And so it was the party stratigraphy detritus.
You know what? That works so well. I want everyone to picture that when they're thinking about what stratigraphy is. Just having this massive party.
Well. It's a good analogy. You know, it's getting pushed down.
Well, that just concerns like the relative dates and ages of each layer. You know that one party came after the other. But what about mm-hmm. absolute dating? How do you nail down when something actually happened?
So I guess we were talking about like the stratigraphy itself, and then you can take that a step further and talk about chronostratigraphy. And if you break that word down, chrono is obviously referring to time, then you've whacked it in front of stratigraphy, which is rock, so it's, you know, time rock. And chronostrat is all about putting some kind of number or date on that system. So I guess, yeah, you were talking about relative ages before, that we know, like in a pile, the stuff on the bottom is the oldest and it gets younger and younger to the top. But like how old are those layers? And I guess with chronostrat, you can talk about the relative ages, but what you would really like is to put absolute numbers on those rock layers. In a sedimentary sequence, the only way you can really get hard numbers, the absolute ages, is by doing radiometric dating on volcanic ashes. So, you know, you have to be like super lucky to be able to get a volcanic ash in the right spot to help you date your system. But of course, you know, you can't actually date the sedimentary rocks themselves. A sandstone, for example, contains a whole bunch of particles, right? But if you dated those individual grains in a sandstone, you would get the age that particular grain formed, not when it was incorporated into that sandstone layer. So we need to combine relative dating methods like biostratigraphy and chemostratigraphy, which I guess we'll talk about, with those absolute dating methods as well.
And so all of this stratigraphic data builds up into effectively what is the geological timescale, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So this is basically, these are the exact methods that people use to build the geological timescale or the chronostratigraphic chart, as it's called. Absolutely.
And so the Cambrian period is divided up into series, and those are further subdivided into different stages. And so yep. What kinds of events define each of the stages of the earliest Cambrian?
The main method that people use is biostratigraphy. So that is looking at the stratigraphic ranges of particular fossils. And we can use fossils to help define periods of time because organisms evolve over time. And so the older rocks will have a different group of fossil organisms or fossils in it than a younger group. And so when we look at different rocks, and this happens, you know, everywhere across the entire timescale, if we find a rock and we're not sure about what age it is, if it's got fossils in it, that can be really helpful because they can be diagnostic of a particular time period when it lived a long time ago. And so biostrat is very important, and you can use it on a very fine scale. And that is nowadays supported a lot with stable isotope chemostratigraphy. So we use carbon and oxygen isotopes and how they change over time. And we also use radiometric dating. So these three different methods, we call it the multi-proxy approach, is used to define time, geological time.
And how does that get incorporated into the geological timescale? Do you say, I found this evidence, can you insert it, please?
Yeah, well, it all comes down to you have to publish all of this information, but that information is kind of then dealt with by the International Commission on Stratigraphy, or the ICS. And they're like the big umbrella body, and they make working groups that deal with different chunks of the timescale. And it's the working group's responsibility to ratify boundaries that need ratifying. So what happens is that people will publish their data, their biostratigraphic or chemostratigraphic or radiometric data, and this will be incorporated into discussions by these working groups, and then they end up voting on the boundaries.
And everyone gets along absolutely perfectly and they agree on every single thing, yeah?
No, definitely not. I think the Cambrian's pretty bad, not for disagreements, but just that we haven't really ratified all of our boundaries yet. The Cambrian is the last period in the timescale to ratify all the boundaries, although we have had some success recently with the Miaolingian and the Wulirian. So they're the new names for what was called Series 3 and Stage 5. So the things that aren't ratified yet are just called Series 2 or Stage 2, 3 or 4. So we're still to ratify the lower boundaries of those particular chunks of time. But I think it's harder probably in the Cambrian. I don't want to make excuses for anybody, but it might be harder in the Cambrian because the Cambrian is kind of a special period of time, and a lot of the rules that are required to be able to ratify some of these boundaries, you know, that they don't really necessarily work so well in a world where we're sort of only developing sort of nascent ecosystems. Like, it just makes it a little bit more difficult, I think, to be able to do it properly in the early Cambrian, and so it's taking a little bit longer.
So there's only one global timescale, and so each of the events that would define a series or a stage, that must apply to the whole world, presumably, or is there any sort of regional variation where this event doesn't really apply here that happens?
Well, to be able to define each of these chunks of time, we need to be able to agree that we can see evidence of this particular chunk of time in different places. And there is a global timescale, but the faunas, because in the Cambrian and in the world today, you know, there are different places in the world where different groups of organisms live, right? And there are these sort of, in the Cambrian, we talk about different realms, and like there's different trilobite realms. There's an Olenella trilobite realm, which has different kinds of trilobites to the Red Lichia trilobite realm. There are different kinds of other fossils that lived in different places. And because of that, those are the kinds of organisms or the fossils that we need to use to make each of the regional schemes. So the regional scheme in South Australia that we have built contains or is utilising fauna that isn't seen in other places. But we need to be able to agree that a particular boundary occurs in two different places, and it is the same. We're talking about the same amount of time. That is a very difficult thing to be able to do, and it might be that one of the reasons, or it is one of the reasons, why it's very difficult to ratify the boundaries in the early Cambrian.
So animals living or organisms living in one place as opposed to another, we refer to that as endemism?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and so Australia has a problem with an endemic fauna, perhaps. Are there any other issues with Australia and how it fits in with the rest of the world? Why is your studies focused on the Cambrian of Australia?
Well, yeah, so for a long time, I mean, the chronostratigraphic work that we have done has been a long time coming. And I guess before this work came out, it was very difficult to put the Lower Cambrian of Australia into any kind of global chronostratigraphic context because we didn't have any way of, you know, relative dating of our early Cambrian or the Lower Cambrian rock sequences. There were these sort of ideas about trilobites in Australia being hugely diachronous in that their appearance in South Australia was apparently much later than everywhere else in the world. And we do have a very strong endemic fauna as well. Although now we can see more and more when we've studied a lot of the Shelley fauna that have come out of the Lower Cambrian rocks in South Australia, we can see that we can do quite a lot of species level, but mostly genus level correlations with other places. So we're doing a lot better than maybe has been previously appreciated.
So that's a lot of things to consider when you're trying to divide up the Cambrian. How much work was this?
Well, my PhD project, which this was a part of, was a 3.5-year gig, but it built on over a decade, maybe 15 years of work of my supervisor and his students and colleagues. So I guess Glenn understood that Australia had a problem in terms of being able to integrate ourselves into a global chronostratigraphic context, but he also appreciated how much work needed to be done to be able to get to this point. And so what that required was extensive amounts of field work and collection. And on top of that, huge amounts of describing of the faunas that are coming out of it. So what you really need to be able to do something like this is to build the scheme on robust and reliable taxonomy. So, you know, the fact that most of the work or a lot of this has been built on papers that were published within the last 10 years or so means that we have a really good base to build a chronostratigraphic scheme.
So it sounds like you're getting a pretty good handle on the biostratigraphy on the whole. So why do you need the stuff with chemostratigraphy, the isotopes?
Yeah, okay. So we do have a really good handle on the South Australian Shelley fauna that we use for the biostratigraphy. But the scheme that we built, we built it on, and we had to do this based on the fauna that we had. Some of the key fossils for each of our zones are endemic. They're only found in South Australia. Or maybe also Antarctica, because in the Cambrian, Australia, Antarctica were very close neighbours, and so we share a very similar fossil fauna. So because we have a scheme that is built largely on endemic fauna, it's very difficult to be able to correlate that with other places in the world, so other early Cambrian or lower Cambrian terrains around the world. So what you're looking for is some way to get a global signal or a global proxy for time. And what is widely used are stable isotopes or carbon isotopes. So that can, if you look at the change in carbon isotopes over time, that can give you a proxy for time that is seen all around the world.
And what's actually changing there? What's controlling the different isotopes of carbon? And where do you even find them?
Yeah, so the carbon isotopes that we're looking at are carbon-12 and carbon-13. Carbon-12, because it's a bit lighter, is more preferentially utilized by organisms in their sort of metabolic processes, because organisms are lazy and so they want to use the easy one, so they go for the lighter isotope. And so when you have times where you get a lot of productivity, there's a lot of organisms using up that lighter isotope, and so it means you get more carbon-13 in the system, and that gets buried. So you end up with these sort of peaks and troughs in a curve, a global carbon isotope curve that's telling you about productivity essentially in the ocean. And because the oceans are actually relatively well mixed, so you can mix the ocean on a 1,000-year timescale or something like this, that means that you should be able to record that that signal everywhere. And, you know, on a geological timescale, that's more or less instantaneous.
And so what process do you use to obtain this data?
To get the carbon isotope data, well, what we did is, and what's widely applied in this sort of circumstances, what's called bulk rock. So because the isotopes are in the seawater, the carbon isotopes in the seawater, that can be precipitated directly out of solution in limestones. The rocks that we're looking at are carbonates, limestones. So we drill small amounts of rock powder and we get that analysed. And so that can give us information about the isotopic values in ancient seawater.
How reliable is this chemostratigraphic data?
Excellent question. And it is. I think that it's right to be suspicious, or at least to err on the side of caution when using isotopic data for chemostratigraphy and correlation. I think that maybe there's been a bit too much made of relying on it almost solely as a temporal proxy for correlating stratigraphic sections. The issue is that there are lots of things that could have happened to your isotopes and your rocks since the rock was made. You know, in the Cambrian, we're talking about something like 500 million years of geologic history. And so, you know, all sorts of things could have changed the ratios of the isotopes, diagenetic processes, fluids running through the rocks, weathering, things like that. So you need to be extremely careful when you are sampling that you are getting rocks that haven't been altered or have been altered as little as possible. Carbon isotopes are a lot more resistant than oxygen isotopes, and the oxygen isotopes are almost always used in tandem with the carbon, and so the oxygen can sometimes tell you whether something has happened to your rock, and so that can help you be critical of what's happening in the carbon. So, you know, and there's also people who work in the modern day are very critical of using carbon isotopes in deep time, because they can see that in the modern day that there are different values for isotopes in different parts of the ocean, you know, in shallow water versus deep water versus epiric system versus open ocean. That translates into, you know, how could you possibly rely on isotopes as a global signal in deep time. But those sorts of ideas maybe don't account for time averaging, which is really important in deep time sort of studies. And the fact remains that there does seem to be a very strong and very consistent carbon isotope curve in the Lower Cambrian. And so it's a matter of sort of working with what we've got.
That sounds like a lot of work to figure that one out.
Yeah.
How difficult has it been to get your head around working with all this chemical data as an artist, as a geologist, and now a chemist?
Yeah, I remember being quite intimidated by doing this, but it was my idea, actually. So at the beginning, my PhD project was essentially just about the fauna and doing the biostratigraphy. But as I carried on and I did more reading, you know, I sort of thought, you know, we really need to be able to, and I realised that our fauna and the ones that were really important for our biostrat were endemic. And I thought, well, what can I do, you know, to put this in the world, in the global scheme, you know? And I approached Glenn and I said, I think we need to try and use isotopes. And Glenn was from the other side at the time, and he said, that's crap and it doesn't work. And I thought, well, I don't know really yet. So, but maybe we should try it, right? And so we did give it a go. And when I first started, I was terrified of contaminating my samples and how to process them and how to interpret the data and stuff like this and what had happened to my rocks. Like I was getting in way deep into the diagenetic history of all of my samples and trying to work out what had happened to them and how that could possibly have wrecked the isotopic values. And so I did lots of thin section analyses. I actually got like really into carbonate petrography and petrology. I really enjoyed that. But, you know, I realized that, you know, to be able to quantify the diagenetic pathways of every one of the samples that we did from all 21 stratigraphic sections, you know, would have been, you know, two or three extra PhDs. And so what I realized then is that actually you just have to sort of, a lot of people kind of go for it without doing any kind of screening work. But we were quite critical of our samples before we even started. And so the results actually were quite good after I worked out what I was looking at. So we saw that there was quite a strong relationship between what was happening in the isotopes and what was happening in the biostrat. So at a particular boundary between two biostratigraphic zones, we were always seeing, you know, positive values or a curve to the positive, for example. So that sort of relationship was happening again and again, and that was sort of enough for us to think that, yeah, they were probably, it's probably a real signal.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Coming soon in the next episode, let's turn our attention now to the biostratigraphy. We're Paleocast, we should be talking about fossils.
Well, that's a good question. It's sort of the life's work of many paleontologists.
Oh, it sounds complicated. It sounds like a lot of work.
Oh, yes. No, Dave, do not scare me like that. For sure, nobody is here.